This B Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. IXL's all-inclusive online teaching and learning platform simplifies edtech needs and accelerates achievement in 95 of the top 100 U.S. school districts. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K-12 curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable, real-time insights at every level of your school or district. This one solution performs work that typically requires dozens of tools. Want to find out why so many leading districts trust IXL? Visit IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE.
All right. Well, good morning. Welcome to the Transformative Principle. This is your host, Eric McKelkey. And on today's show, we have two guests, Dr. Robert Fearson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes. And also joining us, Dr. Seth Weitzman. Welcome.
Nice to be here from New York.
Yes. Yeah. So today's topic, I was personally really interested in when I saw the title of the book that you guys had co-authored, Conflict to Collaboration, a School Leader's Guide to Unleashing Conflicts, Problem-Solving Power. We were talking before we started recording this morning. This sometimes is what keeps principals up at night.
It sure is. You know, it's funny, you run into people as a principal, you run into people at a party and they say, oh, it must be so nice being a school principal. You go home at 3 o'clock, it's a warm and fuzzy place to be. And of course, they don't realize the truth. And for me, that came about because I was very active in suburban New York City at the county level and also the state level, or associations of principals would meet periodically. And I noticed that during the lunch break or after work, when we went out, I'd sit back and listen to what people were complaining about. I mean, everybody can complain about their jobs, right? Mm-hmm. And I noticed that it was teachers versus teachers, and the principal had to sort it out. It was teachers against administrators, often involving unions here in New York. It was parents sending principals overnight emails with subject lines like important issue to deal with. Eric's smiling because he just got one of those last night, actually. But I realized that all of this stuff had a common theme, and that was conflict. Principals didn't like dealing with a conflict on the job, and also didn't know how to as well. And I was in a bookstore one day in the business shelves, actually, looking for books on school leadership. Often you have to look in the business section. And I found one called Leading Through Conflict. And I had an epiphany standing there in the Harvard Coop, was the name of the bookstore, and realized that, you know, maybe there's something I could do about it. Maybe it wasn't just a distasteful part of the job that I had to live with. And there actually is a body of research out there. It comes from business and organizational psychology, but it more than anything, the last 10 years that I was a principal, and I was a principal in total 27 years, but it changed my practice more than anything in the last 10 years.
And were you middle school level principal, Seth?
You can send me condolences, but I loved it, actually. I was a middle school principal in two different school districts for a total of 27 years. Rob was a middle school principal as well, and then went on to become a superintendent.
We met as middle school principal colleagues. And actually, Seth was the middle school principal for my kids. I just remembered that. So I really do have a vendetta here.
They were great kids, and one of them just had a baby 2 weeks ago.
Thank you.
All right. That's a nice connection. So, Rob, where'd your motivation come from with the book based on your experiences?
I think it's twofold. Similarly, from experience, I was a principal, I was an assistant superintendent, I was a superintendent, and certainly a good part of your day as a school leader at any level are filled with the challenges that you don't have on your calendar. You know, you walk in the morning and you think, well, I have to do this, I'll get this done, I'll get that done. And very quickly, it kind of dissembles because one issue or another comes up. And it's often the kind of tension between opposing viewpoints, opposing issues, opposing approaches to something. So certainly that is one. And so when Seth and I talked, it was certainly struck a nerve. And the second piece is that I've been working in higher ed, either part-time or full-time, for a good number of years, and working particularly in school leadership programs with aspiring school leaders, principals, aspiring directors, chair people, superintendents, et cetera. And they always mention almost spontaneously at one point or another that the thing that they are most fearful of is conflict. They worry about how to deal with issues that arise between stakeholders in some level. They worry about dissension and how they'll manage that. They worry about controversial issues and how to approach those things. And even in higher, even principal preparation courses, there is no focus on this topic. So we send people out into the field to learn by experience. And that's not a great way to do it, because what happens is they're unprepared to look at this strategically and to be able to harness conflict for ways to improve their schools.
If you've been listening to Transformative Principle for any amount of time, you know that I have a love-hate relationship with EdTech. We have the ability to personalize learning for every single one of our students, and yet so many of our EdTech tools fall short. We need our technology to do more for us. That's why it's so important for me to know that IXL provides true personalized learning across the entire pre-K-12 curriculum, and that it's proven to benefit all student populations, including English language learners and students in special ed programs. As a principal, I've used this in my school. As a parent, I've had my children use it as well. And let me tell you, this is a tool that definitely helps students learn and practice better. IXL is research proven to accelerate achievement. Studies across 45 states show that IXL schools outperform non-IXL schools on state assessments, and independent research from Johns Hopkins University verifies that IXL meets ESSA Tier 1 standards. With those results combined with IXL's teacher-friendly reputation, what more could you ask for? Now, you also know that I don't care so much about test scores, but I know that they are legislatively convenient and something that we have to deal with and manage on a day-to-day basis. If you can implement something that is easy and effective, why wouldn't you do it? If you have a goal to increase achievement for all students, make sure to find out what IXL can do for you. Visit IXL.com/B for a demo. That's IXL.com/BE.
How often do you see that with your aspiring principals, that their fear of conflict leads to avoiding conflict?
I think it's very common. I mean, it's right on the tip of their tongue, and it's what they'll tell you that they're most afraid of. And what the kind of perspective that we have very often about conflict is that it's a bad thing. So if you are experiencing conflict in some way as a school leader, you've done something wrong. You've made something worse. But the fact of the matter is, as Seth and I learned as we delved into this subject more deeply and thought about our own experiences and reflected upon them in ways that we came out of this productive ways, what you can do is harness conflict. What you can do is address conflict constructively. And when you do that, you do many things that are beneficial for your school. You create better relationships. You foster better communication. You build your school's capacity to solve future problems because you learn how to do these things. In our book, we call this conflict agility, which is basically, Seth often says, it's like a muscle. And if you don't pay attention to it, it becomes unused and deteriorates. But when you exercise these conflict agility strategies, you wind up strengthening that muscle, not just for yourself, but for the school community as a whole.
I just want to go back, Eric, before we move on and talk about how school leaders can manage conflict. I wanted to go back to the question of the impact of neglecting conflict. And of course, you know, any conflict, whether it's in a marriage, family, with your children, what have unaddressed, just festers. But I also believe that some of the substantive issues that we face in school, and I know that mentioning it might be controversial in some places, but issues like racism in school, issues like inequity, I think part of the reason why these issues have persisted is because school leaders have overlooked them for fear of the conflict that they will inevitably bring. There's a great book. There's one book that I like to shout out in these presentations called With the Best Intentions, written by two authors named Lewis and Diamond, that describes exactly this in a high school outside Chicago. Everybody's kind of aware, for parents, school administrators, teachers, everyone's aware of the inequities that exist in the school, but there is an unwillingness to actually deal with them because people fear the conflict that will result and where that will end up.
Yeah, it just kind of festers, and sometimes we put our heads in the sand and just hope, you know, sure. nobody brings it up.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Has the library book situation been as lively on the East Coast as it has been in the West with banning books?
I don't think so. There are, in the county that I live, just north of New York City, Westchester County, there's one school district in particular, but no, opening up a newspaper, the book banning issue, CRT, also has not been the kind of hot button issue that it's been elsewhere in the country.
But I think what we've experienced in, at least in this area in New York and probably surrounding the metropolitan New York City area, is discussions that sometimes get heated over, first of all, during COVID, certainly there were many controversies about when schools should open, shouldn't open, under what conditions, et cetera. But what's come out of that too is a controversy about social emotional learning, its place in the curriculum, what it means, how it should get done. Even the term itself is kind of a hot button issue, which is one of the things that we talk about in terms of strategies, is how to de-escalate those kinds of conversations and turn them into productive discussions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to us that we wrote the book 2 years ago. I think we pressed submit and sent the manuscript on to the editor. And the manuscript was about the run-of-the-mill school conflict that we've been describing among stakeholders in the school. But within 6 months after we submitted the manuscript, the kinds of political strife, CRT, book banning, etc., had, you know, reached national headlines. It's interesting. Rob and I, sometimes we ask ourselves a question, is this the worst period of school conflict in the United States in terms of conflict in the national headlines? And you have to go back quite a few years, we think. I mean, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education and desegregation in the 1970s. This has been a difficult period to be a school leader.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely things that I don't know that anyone was prepared to have conversations about and think would become such big topics. And really, some of those conflicts go way beyond the in-house conflicts with students and staff and parents, and it's more of community-wide statewide or national conflicts. So I mentioned a little bit, guys, that sometimes leaders will avoid conflict, but how else do you see principals approaching conflict? What other approaches are there besides just avoid it and hope for the best?
Well, we say there are three basic approaches. There are the three A's, we call them. One is avoidance. It takes many forms. We've all probably known school leaders who set up committees, ask you to join, and you go, I don't know if I want to join this, because the committee's not going anywhere. They're going to deliberate the issue, and when it comes to recommendations, at some point it gets buried. That's a form of avoidance, right? So avoidance takes lots of different forms. The second A we call aggression. I'm surprised, as also teaching in an ed leadership program at Mercy College here in New York, how many of my students who are all teachers at this point, aspiring school leaders, talk about the aggressive approach to conflict from their principals. And it's everything from, yes, screaming, I can't believe it, as if they think that there's something to be gained, just outright yelling at school staff. But it's beyond that. We also say it's using the incentives and disincentives, institutional incentives and disincentives, in order to coerce an outcome. So for example, who gets the best parking space assigned? Who gets the preferential teaching schedule? What was your end of year rating? I mean, these are the kinds of incentives and disincentives that principals sometimes use in order to coerce an outcome. We say that's a form of aggression as well. And then the third A, as Rob began describing before, is addressing the school conflict. That's being upfront and honest, at the same time, respectful of each other. We kind of put the approach into two different categories. One are the leadership strategies that can be employed, and we have quite a number of them in our book. And the second is a protocol that we adapted from design thinking, which actually comes from the field of engineering, but can be used in a productive way to take on some of the controversial issues we face.
Is it safe to say we should shoot for addressing over avoidance and aggression? Is that always the better choice?
Very safe to say.
Yeah.
I mean, there are times, actually, the serious answer, this is kind of in the weeds, but sometimes it does make sense to avoid. You have the phrase, that's not the hill I want to die on. You know that phrase?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sometimes it does make sense. You can't take on every issue. And we also say in our book that it also is sensible at times to pick the low-hanging fruit, to use another metaphor. We say start by taking on the less consequential conflicts in a school until the faculty gets more accustomed to that and confident in their ability to listen to each other and to reach a resolution. I did that as a school principal. Actually, it's where I started. I began faculty meetings with, I called it for the good of the order, or they kind of mocked that for some reason. I changed it to for the school, for the good of the school. And I invited teachers to bring up issues as long as they were school-wide issues, not my own particular problem, you know, in my classroom or department, what have you. And as long as they were going to make themselves part of the solution. You couldn't just point fingers or offload the problem onto the school administrators. So I would actually solicit issues, and we'd spend the first 10 minutes of a faculty meeting in a community problem-solving exercise. So a teacher might stand up, this is middle school, right? What they look like in the spring. So a teacher might say, behavior in the hallways, this is what's going on. We had the phrase, spring has sprung, right? I'm sure it's everywhere in the world among, I love them, 11, 12, 13, 14 year olds. And together, we would brainstorm solutions to it. I'm the principal, I better get out there in the hall. We all should get out there during the change of classes. Whatever solutions came up, but we practiced group problem solving. And it's an example.
So yeah. What Seth illustrates in that discussion is one of our key principles, which is principle PLE, which is taking a kind of step back and being able to put a structure around these issues, these conflicts, the dissension that you experience, rather than deal with it, you know, fighting it off as it comes to you. What people do with principals is they walk into the office and they dump their problem on you and they walk out. And that's certainly not a way to address something constructively. So everything that we talk about in the book really addresses how to bring people together, how to foster communication, how to encourage dialogue in a productive way so that you engage people in addressing conflict rather than try to battle it single-handedly and fight it off.
I think about that a lot. It's kind of taxing when these situations come up, but the goal always is empower people to solve problems themselves or amongst themselves, instead of, hey, if you come to me, I'll solve this problem for you, because you're just building in that, well, next time there's a problem, it needs to go to somebody else and they'll solve it for me, which isn't, that's not what we want with students, and that's not what we want with staff and parents. So how about this, guys? What about if you have someone you work with that they're really, really good at avoiding conflict? When there is any possibility of any conflict, 100% avoidance, how would you help them start leaning into and maybe trying to flex those conflict muscles a little bit and get out of their conflict cave?
I like that phrase. So the first step, and then I'll turn it over to Rob. I'm stealing this from Rob because this is what he usually begins with. So conflict feels bad. When you're faced with a conflict situation, you start sweating, blotches on your skin, anxiety level rises. So this is pop psychology maybe, but the first thing to do is to take a breath, right? Mm-hmm. Try to relax, calm yourself, realize that maybe this isn't directed at you. Don't personalize the conflict. That's a good, we also have a phrase, I learned it from maybe the school administrator I worked with who I admired most over the years. He had a phrase, the issue isn't the issue, meaning the issue that's presented to you isn't necessarily the real issue that the person has. So the first step is to calm down and to try to get some perspective. And then I'll turn this to Rob.
To follow up with what Seth said, certainly the issue is not always the issue. And I think it's part of in bringing people into the discussion is to kind of understand where they're coming from. We spend a lot of time in the book talking about empathy and developing a sense of empathy, which, again, something that we often think about, but we don't necessarily know how to develop, to try to find out what people are thinking, feeling, saying, and doing. So when you have that kind of reluctant partner, it's really important to really take a good look at all the things that he or she presents. Part of it, sometimes one of the things that we can engage people with is a sense of dissonance, you know, the gap between what they think and what's actually happening, the gap between their beliefs and what's occurring on the ground. And so engaging in a conversation or discussion about whatever that issue is and the gap between what they think they should be and what currently is can be motivating and be encouraging to bring into dialogue. There's also a tendency for us to simplify things all the time. We tend to see things in black and white, and we don't see the shades of color in between. And so perhaps sometimes the first step in working with someone who is taking that kind of very position, I'm not involved in this, I don't want to get involved, I'm not interested, is to make things more complex. Actually, to show them that there are many things involved in a particular situation and that their perspective is a valid one. You know, you could say something like, I understand where you're coming from, and it's a valid opinion, although not necessarily one I agree with. Inviting them to engage in deeper discussion. So we make it more complex. We make it a little bit more complicated than just yes or no. And that often sparks a discussion.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to me that I've been toying with this idea of let's step back and take a look at how our schools function. And you could try this, Eric, today in your school, and maybe listeners can try it again, because it's fascinating to me. And I would do this as well. I'm now retired as a school principal. But so you're sitting in a meeting. Somebody brings up a controversial issue. It could be anything. You know, how do we teach reading? Do we need to monitor the bathrooms more frequently? What have you? And they propose a solution. It's interesting. Just step back next time you're at a meeting and you find yourself in this situation and listen to how people respond. Just pretend you're an anthropologist, maybe, looking at a different culture. Or I used to like the metaphor, pretend you're an extraterrestrial hovering a mile above of Earth, looking at how these earthlings behave. And it's so fascinating to me because people would be, I would notice that, so somebody puts out an idea, you know? So ask yourself, how do others respond? Do they ask questions? The question mark is a lonely punctuation mark in the English language. People just don't like to use it, you know? So in our book, we try to encourage people to, leaders, to get people to respond with genuine probing questions. I say genuine because sometimes people start questions with, well, what about this? Well, what? That's not really a question, you know? That's a judgment disguised as a question. So they start pointing fingers as well. The school leader presents the data. Oh, the fourth grade math results declined this year. And immediately people point fingers. Well, in third grade, they weren't so great either. Or they find some way to absolve themselves or blame other people. It's just fascinating to watch how groups naturally respond. There are psychological reasons to that. So part of our book is trying to figure out how to break these cycles, interrupt the dynamics. A phrase that we use in our book is conflict without divisiveness. That it seems like, the way I put it is, Eric, it's not enough for you and I to disagree. If you're going to disagree with me, I also have to put you down. You're a worse person. You're less intelligent than I am. Obviously, I'm more handsome than you also. You know, the list goes on and on. Of course, it doesn't have to be that way. And we have some suggestions in our book for leaders to establish a new professional norm in the school that we can disagree with each other. But people say, well, disagree respectfully. And of course, that's true. But we have specific strategies that people can use in order to make that come to life.
Seth, I was going to tell you, I sometimes feel like what you were describing, you know, just observing a conflict in a group, because as a new principal, I kind of feel like an observer because there's certain dynamics, and I'm thinking especially among the staff, where you're just watching and observing and noticing body language and tone and who crossed their arms and who's clenching their fist. And so I can relate to that. We're working through, we've started a building leadership team. We call it the Guiding Coalition. And our topic last week, we've tried to start with building some trust, just getting to know each other and be comfortable with each other in a small group. But what we started last week was overcoming that fear of conflict. And it was really interesting to hear the teacher's perspective on why we avoid conflict and how that has worked in the past and what it's going to take to overcome that, because it's hard to change if that's been the culture really in the school.
That's interesting that they were conscious of that, that they could articulate that.
One of the ironies of conflict is that to address it, as you've started to do in your school, Eric, you really need to build relationships. And yet conflict, ironically, tends to separate people. So the key part of the key to the solution is developing those relationships, even though there are forces pulling you apart. There's a tendency to overgeneralize about the opposition side and make it a black and white issue. There's emotionality that clouds our judgment. There's a interest in getting your agenda done and rather than listening and working with the other side. So the conflict is driving people apart. The job of leadership here is to take a more 30,000 foot view of that and find the factors that can bring folks back together and find the ways to either create better communication, build relationships, and really solve the problems that they're addressing.
I do think, as Rob said before, we have this phrase, like, agility, and we do think it's a muscle that can atrophy if it's not used, but also can be toned if it is. And I have this story, and I'm putting it out there to show that we can make progress in this area. And this group, starting absolutely where you should start, which is trust. The mountain grows from a foundation of trust. But this is, again, from experience, that towards the end of my years as a principal, I was interested in inquiry-based learning. And it's a fundamental shift in the role that teachers would play, more as guides on the side, phrases, rather than sage on the stage. And we really did something tremendous in a short period of time and transformed the way that children end the school year, all 1,200 of them in 3 grades. And I'm positive that the reason why we were able to accomplish this was that we had learned how to deal with conflict. And at one point, conflict would have been an obstacle that we never would have surmounted. But because we had practiced in small parts and kind of built on our conflict agility skills, in the end, we had made great progress in curriculum and instruction, because first, we had learned to deal with the inevitable conflict that has to be worked through.
Yeah, and if you have that foundation, then you can take on anything. There's always going to be another conflict.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
Can you guys tell me, you mentioned at the start of the conversation about the design thinking that came from the engineering field. Can you just tell me some more specifics about that? I don't know much about design thinking, and I know nothing about engineering. So I'm just curious how that connection.
Well, neither did we, so don't feel badly. So design thinking did evolve from engineering, and it really is designed, the purpose of design thinking is to tackle what's called wicked problems. Wicked problems are things that defy traditional ways of solution, not the easy things to do. They're not the mechanical things you can adjust. It's not just tinker here and there. It's these big issues that often wind up becoming very conflicted issues in a school. And it's a structured approach to this, which is designed to involve people's best thinking and develop solutions that are meaningful and practical. There are 5 steps involved in it, and I'll just briefly go through them. The first step is empathy, and I talked about that before. The reason empathy is so critical is that empathy really helps you understand the full scope of a problem, because we all have tunnel vision. Everyone sees things from their own perspective. And it's unavoidable. We all carry biases with us, whether it's looking for facts that confirm what we already know, or the tendency to believe people we already have relationships with. We all have that. So the first step is really gathering the sense of what's out there. What are people thinking, feeling, saying, and doing? Once you have that, because as Seth mentioned before, the presenting issue is not always the issue. And often there's an underlying values issue, perspective issue, moral issue, organizational history issue that's motivating it. So once you have that empathy information, you begin to define the problem more clearly. So that's the second step, is define. Once you have the definition, the third step is to what we call ideate. So ideate is a process where we call it thinking, is thinking inside the box. Then people will pose that, say you have to think outside the box. We say ideate is thinking without a box at all. It's pure thought. It's really, what are the possibilities here? With every idea accepted and every idea valued for its own sake, before you begin to winnow it down. And that's one of the errors people make in solving these kinds of issues, is that they tend to throw out things before they get a chance to fully consider them. So ideate is step 3. Step 4 in the traditional model is called, the engineering model is called prototype. And prototype is really quick and dirty, quick and fast. Say, how would we operationalize this? How would we make it come into existence? And thinking about that, sometimes in schools we do pilots like that. But prototypes are really quick, because if you spend a year piloting something, the issue may morph into something else. So then you look at the prototypes, and last step is what we call tests, which is really saying, okay, we think this is the model that will work. Now we're going to begin this, and now we'll begin this in earnest and see if it works and gather data about that. And the process can repeat itself. You may find that one of the things engineers do is that they say, if they get the prototype and the prototype doesn't work or work as well as they expected, they go back in the process and they go back to ideate, or they go back to defining the problem. Maybe they missed it. And it has a real history of success. This approach has a tremendous history of success, not only in engineering, but in business and in a field that I find has many parallels to education, which is healthcare. Because in healthcare too, we're dealing with many, many people. There are many different professions involved. There are levels of professional expertise, and there's an urgency because you're dealing with human life. So it has a real record of success in those areas. Not so much in education, and part of our work is to help people understand how this process can be adapted for use in schools. The beauty of the process is that not only does it create lots of possibilities for solutions, but in that process of dialogue and really engaging creatively with others, it brings people together. So we talked about relationships before and the importance of relationships. It builds those relationships so you don't wind up with a this side and a that side, mm-hmm. you wind up with a problem-solving group.
Yeah, instead of having those opposing teams, I'm on this
right.
team, you're on that team.
Right.
Yeah. I now that you describe that, I wonder if that's where I had a superintendent years ago use, he called it like a 90-day design cycle. Mm-hmm. He would test for 30 days and then kind mm-hmm. of review initial results. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, there are lots of spin-offs from this.
Very similar, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not the way we work in education. Typically what we do, I'm sure you've been on these committees out in Wyoming as much as we've been then on them in New York. You form a committee, it might be a curriculum committee, for example. So you all meet and you write the curriculum and, you know, then you're done and you say goodbye to each other. I'll see you next committee if that forms or, and you're done as if you've reached the all-time perfect solution as opposed to this. I mean, you described it as a 90-day. We're going to go back and reassess and maybe redesign right away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to agree on what success looks like. And then that's really a key piece of the process is what does it look like when it's done? What does it look like when it's successful? So that we're able to say confidently, we've either done it or let's go back and try some more.
Well, thanks, guys. I wanted to throw out the final question to you today. What can principals do this week to be a more transformative leader like you?
That's a very interesting and important question. So thanks for posing it. I think we've kind of addressed that in some way. There are two things, and I think they're both related. One is build trust, because at its bottom, everything we've talked about relies on developing that sense of trust, that sense of that you are what you purport to be, that I can see you being a consistent person, that I can feel that you're honest with me, and that you're approachable. Those things translate for school leaders into many aspects of their work with every stakeholder possible, kids, parents, staff, faculty, you name it. And when you build trust, you build relationships. One of the authors that I like best is Michael Fullan, who studied school change very deeply. And he always comes down to the same phrase, which is it's about relationships. And good relationships are founded on trust.
Am I allowed to slightly modify your question?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would actually think about this. So there are days that you're sitting behind your desk as a school principal. It's probably, let's say, 2 o'clock in the afternoon at this point, and you feel like you've spent your entire day answering emails. There's a mountain of reports. You've been putting out fires all day, and you really haven't moved the organization forward. So this is my answer to the question, and that is do something every day that really makes a difference in your school. Spend an hour every day. Don't go home or let a day go by unless you've spent an hour on something that is crucial to your school and makes a long-term difference.
I love that. I don't always know what that is.
But, and it's different, of course, in every school for every person.
I heard a great principal of the year speech at a state conference, and he talked about principals need to mow the lawn more. And his analogy was that feeling when you get done mowing the lawn and it's clean, the stripes are in it, you're sitting down enjoying a cold beverage, and you see that you accomplished something. Because as a principal, you go home emotionally, physically exhausted, but you oftentimes leave the building wondering, what did I accomplish today?
Yes, true. Yeah. How old are your children? Your children are younger, right?
4 and 2.
Yeah, like what does a principal do? Like they know what a policeman does and they know what a firefighter does. What do you tell them you do?
Last night I had them at the basketball games in the bleachers, and one of my daughters didn't put her shoes back on. And I said, hey, you need to be a good listener. And she said, if I don't, are you going to put me in the principal's office? So
she knows.
someone has told her. I don't know if that came from her mother or who that was, but yeah.
It speaks to the part of the job that people just don't understand unless they're actually in it. And I love the mow the lawn metaphor, that the progress is incremental and constantly building on itself. And it's hard to see sometimes at the end of the school day how exactly you moved the goalpost.
Yeah, it's nice to have that tangible.
Yeah.
In Wyoming, where I've been, it's been a wild winter with snow. So there's no lawn to mow for months. But I come in early and I plow the snow instead of mow the lawn. And it really does feel good when you get done and you look at walks or a section of a parking lot and you see pavement. You're like, okay, no matter how this day goes, I got that reinforcement of I accomplished something, which, you know.
Yeah. This is a personal story. I don't know whether you want to cut this out in the end. So I mentioned before that I take long bike rides, multi-week bike rides. And I normally mow the lawn, but my wife started mowing the lawn in my absence. And when I came back and asked her how she liked it, she said she loves it, actually. She wants to take over the job. And why? She said, I never understood. She said, this is exactly what you were saying before. She said, I never understood. I always thought it was weird that after you mowed the lawn, you would, for days, you'd stare at the lawn. Same thing. When you shoveled the snow, you'd stare at it. She'd catch me at night, like looking out the window at the shoveled, you know, walkway. She said, now I get it. You want to see the lawn that you just mowed and feel like, wow, I did that.
Yeah.
Yes. Good advice for a principal.
Well, thank you guys. Really appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing some resources and ideas to deal with conflict, because it's something we know we're going to deal with, and we can always use some of those strategies to really harness the power of the conflict instead of avoiding it or just getting angry about it. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having us. And certainly we invite your listeners and those who tune into the podcast to contact us, to reach out to us if they have questions and want to continue the conversation.
We'll have a link in the show notes, but did you guys want to share the best way to contact you for listeners who have questions?
Sure. They can email us at info@teacheredge.net. TeacherEdge, one word.
TheHeredge, TeacherEdge, .net.
Great. And then we'll have a link in the show notes to both of your email addresses as well. Thank you guys. Really appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
On the show.
Thank you.
Edited by Gage Sanderson.
Do you want to simplify your school's technology, save teachers time, improve students' performance on state assessments? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to ixl.com/BE. to learn how IXL's research-proven teaching and learning platform can help you achieve all these goals. That's ixl.com/BE.